means that the pitching means that the PG, they were here on time. We have some little bit of some challenges in terms of our transport. There's a new company that has started last week. It still has some teething problems, but that is not an excuse for us. We knew that we have this meeting at 9, could have taken an earlier bus, but it did, honorable members. But having said that, in terms of apologies, I have two apologies, one from Honorable Ngwenya, the other one is from Honorable Kaula. They will not be part of the meeting, otherwise I'm expecting other members to join us during the course of the meeting. Let me take this opportunity and welcome Minister, the Deputy Minister DG, and the entire delegation from the department, and indicate that this is the time where we get a report, a performance report, on the plans they presented to us last year on what they were going to do. This opportunity is not only for reporting, but also corrective measures on things that they were not able to do. What are the plans? Are they part of this year's financial year's plan? And before I continue with give the minister an opportunity to present, I just want to congratulate the honorable minister. Honorable Minister Aaron Mutsvaledi, I was telling him before this meeting that most of the time we are very hard on him, and he's one of the hard-working ministers. Yes, we still do have challenges in our facilities. But before I came back, honorable members, I was given an opportunity to attend a TB caucus summit at The Hague, Netherlands. I realized that in terms of the caucus for politicians or members of parliament, we were the last one to reach. I don't know why. It's an ignorance from our side, because it started in 2014. But one was so embarrassed, because even countries that you will not expect to have launched, they were there. But for us, we just launched recently, September. And it happened that I'm the co-chairperson of the caucus together with the chairperson of the portfolio committee. But what I've learned is that, which we really appreciate, Minister, from your side, your hard working, the impact of the work that you are doing in the country. As a country, we are leading almost everyone in terms of TB treatment and prevention. We are not there as yet. When they were talking, I was reminded how many times the minister had been emphasizing the issue of TB. I don't know whether, minister, we did not take you serious, or were part of the people who did not take TB serious as compared to other infectious diseases. We had, minister, always compare it with Ebola, and said, look at how many people who died in South Africa. We did not have a death in South Africa in terms of Ebola. But we did so much. Everyone was talking about it. They were called. We also called you, minister, with your team. Tell us, how ready are we? But we never did that with TB. And there are more people who are dying with TB as compared to these other diseases. Maybe with this caucus, we will be in a position to support you. My congratulations goes to the minister and the co-chairperson. They got an award for putting together the caucus. They started the caucus 2014 with how many members?
Five.
Only five members of parliament. but now they are sitting at 2,000 members. I can't remember the name of the award, but both of them. Kochon Award. They got that award, both of them. The minister's co-chairperson is from USA. UK, from UK, yeah. Oh, Herbert's from UK. Yeah, he's from UK. They are co-chairing the caucus globally. But the minister also got an award as a minister for the work we've done as a country. Without our support, yes, with the minimal support that we've been giving him, but being a patron, minister, you don't know how many meetings I had. They thought we were part of assisting you. So many NGOs wanted to meet with South Africa just to check what we are doing, how we're working. We really appreciate that. Sometimes we look internally in the country that we think we're not doing enough. But the impact of work that you are doing is seen by everyone. To lead countries like your USA, UK, is not a child's play. Because those people have got all the resources you want. But we've been able to achieve what we've achieved as a country. Members not long will be informed. I think all of us will be part of that TB caucus. We've been requested as Parliament to constitute a structure which we're requested to submit names from the NCOP 9 names, from the NA it will be 10 names. We have submitted names of members. In our discussion, unless something else changes, I've indicated that people who are more relevant, who are dealing with health issues, are members of the committee. You may be informed later, but I just want to say congratulations, Minister. A round hands of applause will really encourage them. Thank you very much. I will not waste time. I'll go straight to the presentation. We don't have much time, Minister. We invited SAPA. Because I was also, we were really attacked, Minister, that we announced 2015 that we're going to have drug for children, which is better than what we are doing now. I may not remember the drug. The chairperson from Kenya, the African chairperson, indicated that we are not doing enough as a country. We are not using it because it has not been approved by our drugs regulatory authority, which is SAPRA. The main reason why we are here today, we want to know what is happening. Because you're not just like any structure. Your delay, your backlog is not like a backlog of houses. Because people may be sitting in informal settlement when you are delayed, but your backlog may mean that people are dying because you have not approved a drug. So it's not just a simple backlog. So we invited them, Minister, precisely for that. I promised in that meeting, is one of the commitments I made, that I will follow up when I go back to the country. We want to know what is happening. We understand your backlog. We don't want to interfere with the work, but with this one, you'll tell us what is happening. You may have to prioritize it. We will want to see it. We're not saying approve it, but we're saying look at it. If it has to be approved, do it. We can't wait for children, like I'm saying, dying because you have a backlog. Your backlog is not like any other backlog. It's about the people's life. So for me, it's very much important. I will hand over to you, Honourable Minister. We are giving you 1 hour. We are breaking at 10 to 11. Yeah, we'll give you 1 hour to do your presentation. Maybe after you have made your presentation, we'll request them to come in because they are here. Over to you, Honourable.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members. And thank you very much for the accolades. I was very happy when I saw you in the Netherlands because I know I've been attending the lung conferences, as you said, since 2014, and you learn a lot there, and I'm sure you have learned exactly the world of TB. That's why lots of things were revealed to you. However, in the interest of time, Chairperson, I would like the DG to present, but time and again, I'll keep on stealing some few minutes to comment further on my side, especially the issue you've just addressed with SAPRA on TB. I've got, you know, just a small sentence to say about that. But the DG will take over the presentation.
Morning, honorable members and honorable colleagues. We're presenting the committee, our annual report. I will just run through some of the slides and mention the highlights. This is the purpose of this presentation, but it's just to reflect on our achievements and also reflect on those areas where we didn't perform well. If you go to the 2030 National Development Plan, we had identified these specific areas that we'd like to raise life expectations, improve TB prevention and cure, reduce maternal infant child mortality, prevalence of non-communicable diseases, reduce injury, accidents and violence by 50% from 2010 levels, but also continue to improve the performance of the health system and establish the primary health care team so that they can visit households, particularly community health workers, as part of the ward-based primary healthcare outreach teams, and implement universal health coverage through national health insurance and field posts. So all of these are what is reflected in the national development plan. So in our annual performance plan, to mirror what is in the national development plan, these are the outcomes that we had set ourselves. And in response, under Program 1, Administration, our vacancy rate was 12.5%, and this is just slightly above the DPSA target of 10%. We had budgetary cuts on COE, cost of employment, by Treasury, and we had to monitor our budget very closely. But in addition, we have not filled posts as people vacate. So we've reorganized the department to try and deal with those. The second was about a recruitment process. It's supposed to be within 6 months. We did that within 4 months. And thirdly, the unqualified audit opinion was what we achieved. But we also wanted to take provinces along and provide support, and our performance remains the same, meaning there are still provinces that have not achieved unqualified audit. For instance, in our plan target, we wanted to support 5 provinces to achieve unqualified audit, and if you check, only 4, Eastern Cape, Free State, Gauteng and Western Cape, obtained unqualified audit, and others didn't. But we'll continue to support them. The others I've already referred to. With regard to the continuity business plan, we self-assessed. We meet the ISO 22300 standards. And there are a few areas that require corrective action. Our communication messages have improved. I think honorable members will recall that we also shared the PILA campaign with you. It's one of our key communications. And a matter that you've consistently raised to say you are not communicating. So in response, we started the pillar campaign. So under this program, there's only one official who didn't sign a performance agreement. That's why our performance is 99%. It's our official who is in health attaché in Brussels. He submitted late. It was signed but submitted late. So we don't include it when we report to DPSA. For Program 2, Honorable Members, on National Health Insurance, the white paper was finalized and gazetted in June. We identified technical committees that are supposed to be established. And the idea here was that these technical committees are supposed to do groundwork. One is supposed to look at how tertiary services are organized in the public sector and link to the referral system between primary health care and higher levels of care. The second is about human resource for health, because there's been a number of middle-level workers that have been identified to provide support. So in planning for your human resources, how do you balance between middle-level workers and your specialties, and how do you continue to have a cutting-edge research project? How do you invest in your human resources to feed into responding to your burden of disease? So all of those would have been through this committee. And also continuously looking at whether what type of health workforce do you need for the country to respond to the burden of disease whilst planning for national health insurance. The third is the healthcare benefits. When you develop a national health insurance scheme, you have to look at the package of services that must be provided, and that determines the affordability of national health insurance. If you promise South Africans you'll give them everything and you'll give everybody everything, it may not be affordable. So you may start small and determine which categories of your beneficiaries will be included and who will not be included. So that sort of kind of background work that must be done. So here we had proposed that there'll be a committee that does that work. The next one is about pricing advisory committee that will look at pricing in the private sector, particularly of providers. How are they reimbursed? What is affordable? But in addition, look at the pricing of pharmaceuticals, the pricing of services in general, and use that and the costs that cost in both the public and the private sector as to what will continuously make NHI affordable. So you need an advisory committee that will continuously also look at the benefit package as to whether it's affordable or not, how do we make it affordable, and that will be also informed by the health technology assessment that we conduct on an ongoing basis. So you'll see that we had proposed a health technology assessment committee. In addition, you'd have to consolidate your financing arrangement, both in the public and private sector. In the public sector, we have a lot of financing arrangements. We collect fees, we've got grants, we've got equitable share, so you'll have to look at how do you consolidate all of this so that you have a much more coherent system of financing. Instead of having multiple streams of financing, you have donor fund and so on. So it was mainly to look at that, but also look at the private sector arrangements, out-of-pocket payments, what is, core payments, or who should be paying, who shouldn't be paying, what are the exemptions. So there's still quite a bit of work that's needed, and you needed all of these structures to do this kind of work in advance. The last one would have been the National Health Commission. Now, the National Health Commission is supposed to look at risk factors that drive the non-communicable diseases. Like, for instance, all the risk factors, because they affect all government departments. The Department of Sports has interest in this, in that they get funding from the beverage industry. So there are a number of departments that have interest in this. The private sector has interest in this. Civil society has interest in this. Labor also has interest. So the National Health Commission would be led at the level of a deputy president. In some countries, they are led by the prime minister. and because it's the coordinating structure for all stakeholders to come to solve the problems that that afflict us. So we've got two bills that have been published for comment, and I think they are in the process of being finalized. So where we are now, I thought I would give that kind of overview. So, honorable members, we came here and explained the centralized chronic medicine dispensing and distribution system that was implemented, and so far, since this its inception, we now have just over 2 million patients that are benefiting from CCMDD. It's the centralized chronic medicines dispensing distribution. I think there are also about 855 pickup points where people collect their medicines. They don't have to go back to hospital, to queue or clinic. They can just go and collect their medicines. Equally, we've introduced a stock visibility system called SVS and installed it in our facilities. It is now present in 3,168 primary healthcare facilities. And this helps to monitor stocks and it's some form of stock management system. So far, we have also introduced what we call provincial basin procurement units. We were supposed to have established these in Mpumalanga and Northern Cape. So far, we only did it in Northern Cape. We have not yet completed the Mpumalanga by the end of the financial year. But this is work in progress. But we have the Traditional Health Practitioners Act, which was supposed to be amended. So we've got the amendment bill, and this will be going out. I don't think we'll be able to conclude this bill in this sitting. So we will perhaps next year publish it for public comment so that it can be implemented, because we must have a stakeholder engagement. For program 2, e-health information system, we have migrated data and we have also implemented what we call HPRS, where we register patients on our system. This has been by the end of March. We have installed this in 1,854 primary healthcare facilities, and there are over 20 million users of services that have been registered on the system. And this is going to form as a master patient index. And it's a starting sort of a initial steps of introducing electronic health records that people have been saying we need to have it in our health system. But I think it's also important because it's going to help us with a unique patient identifier. So I think I've covered this. In addition, we also have a web-based system that helps us to, on an ongoing basis, to know whether patients are funded or unfunded. So that repository that we're busy installing in our hospitals is going to be important for that. So we also have a system of monitoring suppliers. If suppliers don't deliver, we will know that they have not delivered. We follow up with them to know why they have not been delivered. In most instances, it's because they have not been paid. And we then follow up with provinces that have not paid. We write them letters to pay suppliers so that we don't run into problems of stock unavailability. With regard to our international treaties, we have a number of treaties that have been finalized and also multilateral frameworks that have been finalized. According to those that we had planned, we had bilateral frameworks and projects, but we identified 28 of these, and these have been implemented, and some of them are largely in the African region. So quality of care, even though we report on our health system's performance, we also want to ensure that we understand what the views of the users of services are, what their experiences are. So we have developed tools to do that and guidelines. the patient experience of care surveys. We conduct those every November, as well as a system of complaints, compliments, and suggestions on how the public sector is performing, particularly hospitals and clinics. We also have a patient safety incident reporting and learning in the public health sector. So all of these reports, we actually conduct surveys in both the hospitals and the clinics, and these reports are available. Honorable members, we can share them with you. We were part of the Global Lancet Commission that was initiated by Harvard School of Public Health, and the Global Lancet Report Commission has been released. But in addition to that, we have national commissions that have been established in 8 countries, and South Africa is one of them, and the report will be released on the 11th of December this year. And the service, like I say, will share these reports with you.
Just a small remark for members of Parliament to understand the whole concept of Lancet Commission. Time and again, when you talk about the quality of care, especially during towards universal health coverage globally, and of course in Asia and South Africa, many a time we don't know what you're talking about when you say quality. In other words, what is the measurement? What is the measurement of quality, where you'll say, okay, this thing sees this measurement is qualitative. Time and again, we compare apples with oranges. Yes. So the Lancet Commission, one of the things it's going to do is to set up standards, not globally. For instance, if you come to a very far rural village in Africa and look at the clinic, is it correct to compare it with the standards of a clinic which you found in New York and say this clinic is of poor standard because I saw a clinic in New York, this is what's happening. Is it fair? Can the world ever arrive at that level where a clinic in a far rural village of Africa with no roads to go there has to attain the same standard of care with the one in New York? I'm giving that example. So, but time and again, such comparisons are made. Even here in South Africa, where you compare private rural clinic and a city-based in the center of the city, private clinic with a rural clinic and compare the standards. So the work of the Global Lancet, one of them, is to set up what should be called quality in each and every country, depending on or linked to their level of development, the GDP, the household income, the human development index of that country, and say, this is your quality. Please meet it. That is the quality of this country. They must meet it. So when they assess you next time, they assess you on the standard that is specific for your country, not specific for another different country. So that in that way, we have got a measuring rod. We have got a ruler to measure whether you are there, we are there or not. At the moment, I'm sure you are aware, it's a very murky field there about the issues of quality. Thank you.
Thank you. On program 3, this is about HIV, AIDS, TB, maternal, child, and women's health. You'll recall, honorable members, that we implemented Mom Connect, and this was launched in 2014, and this was mainly aimed at improving access to early antenatal services and empowering pregnant women to reach their potential, particularly to ensure that they access services, maternal services in our facilities of good quality. So far, we've reached a cumulative number of almost 2 million actually, because it's 1.888918 million pregnant women and mothers by end of March. So for the school health program, the integrated program that we established has actually contributed to the well-being of learners in that we screen them. And if you check for grade 1 learners and grade 8 learners, we've been able to screen as of April 2017 to 2018, end of March 2018, about 387,574 grade 1 learners and 193,438,000 grade 8 learners. Now, in total, over a period, because we started this a while ago, we've actually screened 4.3 million learners since we started this program. And of those, just over 500,000 of them have been identified to need certain services that affect their learning and cognitive abilities. And these are barriers that must be addressed, in that we need to ensure that having screened them, they must access services. Like, for instance, those who have hearing problems and need to get hearing treatment. For instance, we need to understand what it is, whether it's, you know, wax removal, or whether because of compaction, or whether they need hearing aids. So based on assessment, we'll be able to identify interventions that are needed for each of the learners. But it's almost like 500,000. It's quite a significant number of these learners, because it will affect them long term, and it will affect their performance. Equally, we've introduced HPV vaccines for those girls who are eligible. In 2017-18 financial year, it was about 82.6% that were reached, particularly for the first dose. The second dose is always a problem, in that it's much lower, so it was only 61.3%. As to HIV and TB, since we started the HIV counseling and testing campaign in 2010, over 44 million people have been tested, but some of these are repeats, like people go back again to be tested. But a total of 13,872,315 million people were tested for HIV. This is just for this financial year, which was more than our set target of 10 million, because we had said that on annual basis we'll test 10 million people, but we just exceeded that by just over 3 million. So at the end of March, those remaining of ART on antiretroviral therapy reached 4.2 million people. But fewer infants are being infected, and we're pleased to say that in 2017-18, our PCR tests that were conducted at 10 weeks showed that our positivity rate is sitting at 0.95%. So we'll even go below the 1% mark. And the target here is that we must reach zero. So we're getting there. TB line treatment success rate has reached 84.4%.
Chairperson, just to emphasize the fact here, because it's very important. Just to remind the House that, because we are dealing with percentages there that might not, yeah. Just to remind the House that by 2004, South Africa had 70,000 babies born HIV positive every year. We had reached that number by 2004. Because of this prevention of mother-child transmission, the figure has fallen below 4,000. So that percentage there is something that moved from 70,000 to below 4,000, meaning we are moving towards that period where we might say no more babies are born HIV positive in South Africa. I'm sure you are aware that Cuba reached that data 3 years ago, so we're still moving towards that.
With regard to TB, our new TB line treatment success rate has reached 84.4%, whilst the death rate was at 3.9% in this financial year. So this is the same as the previous financial year.
Again, Chairperson, I like putting it in figures because then it shows, especially when it comes to TB, because you said we have been neglecting it. We had already reached about 79,000 deaths by 2006 for TB. We are now below 28,000. We're coming down gradually because of this program. So the percentages there mean that TB deaths are dropping dramatically, even though it's still a sketch, as you heard from the Netherlands. It's still a sketch globally, but our figures of TB deaths are starting to come down.
So because South Africa had to ask you, if you do have figures per day or per month, how many people are dying? TB patients?
We just know that there are 4,000 people who die every day globally from TB, every single day. I'm not sure whether I've got figures here from the DDG. Responsible for that is not with us. It's in a conference in Namibia. I will be giving figures, but they are there.
The ones that we don't know, we know that they are infected, but they are not dead.
Yeah. Yes, globally, it's estimated that there are 10 million people in the world who have got TB. That makes it the biggest infectious disease killer of our time, of all infections. Now, out of that 10 million, 6 million are on treatment globally. There's another 4 million, which is called the missing 4 million. It's missing because we know they are there in terms of mathematical modeling, but they've not been found. And that's the biggest problem the world is faced with. Now, every country has its own quota of the missing. Out of that 4 million, how many are missing in this particular country? How many are missing that particular one? In South Africa, the missing ones are 160,000. In other words, we know now that of all the people who are treating for TB, 160,000 are still out there. Now, the worry around the world is that each one of them has got the capacity to infect 15 others within their lifetime. So you then multiply 15 by 4 million to see exactly what the world is faced with. So when we went to the UN for the heads of states, one of the things we're asking heads of state to do, can they make resources available to look for these missing people and put them on treatment? That's the homework which has been given to heads of states around the whole world. Now, in South Africa, on the 1st of December, when we launched the search campaign, remember that the president announced in the State of the Nation that we must look for 2 million more people with HIV to put them on ARVs. When we do that in the next 24 months, we're also going to look for 80,000 people with TB, put them on treatment. In other words, half this missing number in South Africa divided by half in the next 24 months.
So, honorable members, for us to reach those targets, each of the districts must have implementation plans. I think it's not only just to reach the targets, but also to meet our obligations of 1990, both for TB and for HIV. So each of the 52 districts must have implementation plans. So far, we've been able to assist 25 districts. I think in this financial year, we have to help the remaining 27, so that all 52 have these plans to move towards achieving the 1990 targets for both HIV and TB. So, honorable members, the MDR-TB, we're supposed to also respond. We spoke about TB. I thought I needed to highlight MDR-TB, that 18 MDR-TB treatment initiation facilities were planned for 2017-18. We've been able to reach and initiate treatment in 22 facilities, and also we had to have, I think, 15 hospitals implementing fast, and that was what was targeted, and we reached about 17. 24 facilities were reviewed, for whether they have people who supervise and support visits, because you know the number of facilities have to track implementation of our TB program. So there must be close supervision and also support for those facilities. So at least we've got about 29 of these that have been doing this appropriately in line with what was targeted. I think for program 4, which is mainly a program dealing with primary health care.
Just before they go to program 4, on this TB again, we might not be here when SAPRA presents, we might be gone. But you raised a question that affects both SAPRA and us after your international conference, where you said the member of Kenya was pushing very hard about these formulations. Chairperson, is one of the intriguing things that happened in our modern times. The world is so highly developed, especially with technology. But again, what I was telling you before we started the meeting about the way TB was neglected. Throughout history, there's never been pediatric formulations for TB. That means we never had children's medicine. When a baby, whether it's 3 months or not, suffers TB, you must take an adult tablet and break it into pieces. It has been happening in the whole world. Now, recently, there are pediatric formulations that are coming to the market. That means in the form of liquid, which babies can swallow, or in the form of a sprinkler where you can sprinkle it on the food that the baby is going to eat, so that becomes their treatment. Now, SAPRA has got good news. They will report to you. They have registered some of them, which means the end of mothers with young babies, the agony is going to be over because of that registration. But I just want to warn, unfortunately, I won't say it publicly here, what you experienced with the push that we've been having has got other unknowable, what you call, which I'm not at liberty to mention here, so that you shouldn't be pressurized. Meaning that, from what I know, even the registration by SAPRA is not going to please the person who was pushing you very hard at an international conference. I'll share that with you personally. Thank you. But the good news is that we no longer are going to experience problems with pediatric formulations. You don't know about that registration because it happens only a few weeks back, but it will come out to the fore. So it's not true that SAPRA has just been folding their arms. Thank you.
Chair, just in conclusion, under Program 3, like I was talking about MDR-TB, South Africa is probably the only country in the world that has done an access program on bidacolim. And we've seen significant results, and I think with the approval of the product, because normally a product that's not registered fully would not be allowed in the market. So we've introduced an access program where we get conditional approval, and I think perhaps when they present, they can talk about that so that it's known that we've been able to put patients with MDR and XDR-TB on treatment to access bidacolim, which they would otherwise not access.
I'm sorry again, Chairperson, I know we only have an hour, but this is important. I'm sure you heard, I attended the same lecture with you in The Hague by the professor from Canada. If you remember, a member of parliament from one of the East European countries asked him, is there any country that is doing everything right on TB in the planet? He said there is none, but if he has to choose one, he will choose South Africa, if you remember that. And of course, no member of parliament here in South Africa will believe it, but you heard it. It was said by a professor from Canada. One of the things is, this bidacolim PG is talking about, it's a new drug for multi-drug resistant TB. 60% of all the people who are on bidacolim in the whole world are in South Africa. We number one, we have put 60%, the whole world is sharing the remaining 40%. What is now the what does it mean? What are the implications? When people have got multi-drug resistant TB, they are put on a cocktail of drugs. They drink lots of tablets. But one of them is an injection called kanamycin, which they must take every day for 18 months. They must poke you with that injection every single day for a period of 18 months. Now, that's trauma. Secondly, it causes what they call ototoxicity. It kills your hearing. You can go totally deaf when you've been hearing before. So patients were now forced, or doctors were forced, to choose between your life and your hearing and say, we are going to give you back your life, but we are going to lose your hearing. Now, with the introduction of pitavalin, all that disappears. The poking every day for 18 months is gone. The loss of hearing is gone. The cure rate goes very high. In fact, for extreme drug-resistant TB, our cure rate used to be 20%. That means we could only cure 80% of people with extreme drug-resistant TB. The others were perishing. 80% were perishing. With the use of pitavalin, our cure rate for multi-drug-resistant TB, extreme drug-resistant TB, has moved from 20% to 61%, meaning we can now save 61% of the people. So I just wanted to know that the introduction of pitavalin was not just a pharmaceutical action. It has actually changed the life of people in our country. And that's why the professor was talking the way he was talking. Yeah.
Perhaps, Minister, in addition, there will also be a combination of both pitavalin and dilamine, which will also be used to improve response, but also increase the numbers of SDR. I mean, those increase the treatment of people with XDR. And this is another access program that we'll be introducing soon. In fact, we've started with that on a trial basis as a research project, but it's been approved, and there are patients who are benefiting through Section 21 by SAPRA. So under Program 4, we have about 1,500 facilities that qualified as ideal clinic. We'd like all our clinics actually to be considered ideal. And with regard to environmental and port health services, there are 20 districts that are rendering municipal health services. And these were audited, and 13 out of 20 reached 51%. Honorable members, this is an area where we would like to really, really make investments. Because if our municipal health services improve because of the social determinants of health, then it means our primary health care services will show performance. So our poor municipal health service have implications for primary health care. So we'd like to make investments in this particular area. Our 10 ports of entry were assessed, and they are compliant with international health regulations. We've also been subjected to a joint external evaluation by the World Health Organization, and we actually came out, I think it was 75 and 80% compliant. There are probably areas where we need to make investments, like for instance in the area of nuclear regulation, we have to improve food control regulations. I think it's in those and hazardous substances in general. We do have regulations, but we just have to strengthen our capacity to regulate. So the ward-based primary healthcare outreach team, honorable members, we have the National Health Council approved the guidelines and the policy for the ward-based primary healthcare outreach team. We have also assessed which ones are functional, which ones are not functional. Our target was to at least have 2,000 functional ward-based primary healthcare outreach teams, and we've got about 3,000 of them out there. So what we'll be doing in this financial year is to train all these teams and ensure that they can visit households and intervene. And this is one other aspect of strengthening our primary healthcare services. municipal health services, our ward-based primary health care outreach teams are going to serve as a foundation of strengthening our primary health care services. Honorable members, we have interest in ensuring that people with physical disabilities can access services. So far, 36 of our primary health care facilities are accessible to people with physical disabilities. So we have to ensure that all our facilities are accessible, not only a certain percentage. We'll do that in our clinics, but also in our hospitals.
PG, I know it's written there, 86%, but because it's recorded, you said 36 of our facilities. Can we just correct
36%,
that?
36%.
Yes, it's 36%, not 36
percent,
facilities. Yes.
36%. I think it's probably a typo, because in the annual report is...
No, yeah, it's 6%. I'm sure. Yes, I said when you mentioned it.
Yes. Honorable members, we also have interest in addressing risk factors. Remember, I mentioned that the National Health Commission is supposed to be established, led by the Deputy President, and it must still be established, like it's one of those committees that I referred to. They are meant to reduce risk factors and improve and help us with the improvement of management of non-communicable diseases. In doing that, we also have to work with other government departments. And whilst we're waiting for the establishment of the National Health Commission, we started working with different government departments, but also provinces, just guiding them on healthy meal provisions in the workplace. You know, they've got canteens, and I think even in Parliament, there are canteens. So we want to guide them on what are healthy meals and how do they provide those meals. So far, three government departments have already done that. That is Department of Education, Higher Education, Basic Education, Social Development, and in nine provinces, the National Guide for Healthy Meal Provision in the Workplace. It's mainly targeted at we in provinces, it was the offices of the Premier, Treasury, Departments of Transport, Sports, Arts and Culture, Agriculture, Public Works, Human Settlements, Tourism. So the idea is that they must have a culture of providing healthy meals for the employees. So the guidelines, on again, we have interest in ensuring that early childhood is supported by good nutrition. So we develop guidelines for the early childhood, you know, the crèches and so on. What they feed babies and children is of interest to us. So we've also prepared guidelines on what is it that they must feed children in those facilities. So we do, from time to time, do random monitoring of food content in foodstuffs, but we can't do much about the table salt on our table because people... It's that one we can't regulate, unfortunately. It's only where we have processed food, we check the content, we guide the restaurants, we have partnered with some NGOs to just work with them on how they work with restaurants to regulate salt content. Mental health, we have tried to get districts to set up teams so that they can implement the strategy, our mental health strategy. And so far, only 14 districts have these teams out of 52. So this is not good. So we will be working with provinces. And I think they've expressed that they've got a very... the COE is kept. They can't recruit more. So we're looking at how best we can work with them. But it is important that we have appropriate teams. For instance, interdisciplinary rehabilitation teams that includes physiotherapists, speech and hearing, or audiologists, occupational therapists, orthoptists, and prosthetists, because they are needed, particularly to support people with both disabilities but mental health care users. Our malaria cases, we've not done very well in this past financial year. In particular, Limpopo has seen an increase in malaria cases. We were able to secure funding to support them to try and reduce the cases. As you may be aware, that our planned target was to have 0.2 malaria cases per 1,000 population at risk, but our achievement was 2.1 malaria cases per 1,000 population at risk. So it is of concern because we're one of the countries that has been identified as malaria elimination countries, meaning we're supposed to be moving towards elimination. And I think one of the key areas is if we can spray. It's evidence. It has been shown that if we spray regularly, we can actually control. But of course, our border problems with Mozambique are also key to our increase in the numbers. But in addition to that, it's just a poor management on our side in this province in particular.
Yeah, Chairperson, on the issue of malaria, in fact, tomorrow there's a meeting in Namibia, which unfortunately I won't be able to attend, but our officials are already there. A meeting of what is called E8. Within SADC, we believe that 8 countries are in a position to eliminate malaria if we work smart enough within the next maybe... In less than 5 years' time, we believe 8 countries in SADC will be able to eliminate malaria. 4 of them are quite advanced, and the other 4 will come a little bit later. Unfortunately, we had a setback. The first 4, which are advanced, is South Africa, is Namibia, is Swaziland, and... what is the 4th one? Botswana. They are advanced. Then the other will follow later. Zimbabwe, Zambia, Mozambique, etc. Now, in the past year, as the DG is explaining, we had a big problem in Limpopo, an upsurge in Limpopo, which raised our malaria incidence. But 6 other countries out of the E8 experienced a similar thing. That means only 2 countries remained where they are. The other 6 moved backwards, including South Africa, because of what happened in Limpopo. An emergency meeting of E8 was called to discuss this issue. And we found that what has happened in those countries can actually be reversed. That's why we're having an E8 meeting tomorrow, because we want to catch up again. Remember, in South Africa, the province that must wake up if we are to eliminate malaria is Limpopo, Mpumalanga, and KZN. Limpopo for the 2 districts, Vembe and Mopani, Mpumalanga, Ehlanzeni, KZN, Umkhanyagude. If those 4 districts can wake up, then this problem will be over, because there's no other part of the country that has got a problem in relation to that.
So we've developed regulations for organ transplantation, dialysis, but also a strategy for oral health and eye health care. So these have been drafted, completed, and costed, and we will be implementing in this financial year. With regard to Program 5, this is largely a program for hospital tertiary services and workforce development. A national core curriculum for nursing has been finalized. It was piloted in 3 provinces, and 8 of the 17 public nursing colleges have been supported to work towards finalization of this curriculum. And in this financial year, we also developed staffing norms for all PC levels, but also we started the work again for hospital level. So when it comes to the core standards, we didn't do very well here, in that we had targeted that 43 hospitals will meet national cost standards. Only 37 of these did. 8 central hospitals, 15 tertiary, and 14, so we did not meet our target. And for the those that were benchmarked to for improved organizational structures, none of these, and this is the work that we're doing with the Department of Public Service Administration. So one of the reasons is because provinces said it's going to be costly to implement these revised structures. But it's an important principle in that, in our opinion, if we implement these structures, it's going to strengthen local decision making, it's going to improve accountability, and it's also going to help ensure improved performance in these hospitals. But the provinces have indicated that they don't have money. So these structures are going to be costly for them. And I think it's things like having a CFO in a hospital, particularly hospitals that manage huge budgets, having an HR team so that they can monitor the performance of employees within that hospital. So those are sort of necessary things that should be in place, but they say they're costly. On the human resource for health standards, we have finished the standards for hospitals. We are implementing for primary healthcare facilities, but we started development of standards for hospitals. A ministerial task team was established for expanded integration program, particularly for the Nelson Mandela International Program. It's led by the Deputy Minister. You will know that by now we had to receive a significant number of students, a very exciting program indeed. They are set to be integrated. The first lot was 720. They almost brought up Campbell to a standstill. Imagine over 700 students coming out all at once and pushing their trolleys coming back home to finish their final leg of study. And we had another round coming. So this, like I said, was led by the Deputy Minister. He's been able to integrate them back, huge numbers of students, and I think we'll have a similar round next year like this. And they have started actually their program in South Africa. We had to have some preparations before they come back. Remember, our universities do not have such large numbers coming all at once. So it was for the first time that they had to receive so many students back at home. So for tertiary hospitals, we have 17 tertiary hospitals that have approved national tertiary services grant business plans. You know, these are the grants that we normally report on, but it's always a problem on how they spend money and what they spend money on, particularly for these grants. So it's important that we monitor those business plans. And I think we'll see when we come to report on the grants. And I'll hand over to the CFO. You'll see the level of performance of different programs. For nursing qualification, I've already mentioned that we have developed the new curriculum that will be implemented by both colleges and universities. And also, we've developed a national policy for the management of nursing placement agencies. Remember, there are these fly-by-night agencies, so we had to come up with guidelines. Otherwise, they were just doing as they wish, so we had to have some guidance. The nursing standards for decentralized clinical training, a platform has been drafted as well to improve clinical training, and I think it will support this integration of students, but also for nursing, because when they come back, they are not just going to be trained in our academic institutions, hospitals. Tertiary hospitals. We're also going to use the primary healthcare facilities as a training platform. So we had to come up with a clinical guidelines, training platform guidelines.
For under the district, 197 facilities that will be maintained. I think this is largely infrastructure-related activities. Even in this area, we didn't do so well. We had planned about 197 facilities to be maintained, repaired, and refurbished. Only 107 were, and 321 had to be maintained. And remember, we had the NHI districts, and this is where we perform the functions ourselves at national. The non-NHI, that are those that are outside the NHI area. The provinces had blamed 321, they only did 79. And for the 42 clinics and community health centers, we had, they were supposed to be revitalized, and only 27 of these were. And 8 hospitals were supposed to construct 8, there's only one that was constructed. And we're supposed to ensure about 50 new facilities. We've developed norms and standards for new infrastructure. And any new facility, hospital, clinic, has to comply with these norms and standards. And at least 52 of these were compliant. So it shows that there's an improvement in the quality of infrastructure that has been, the new infrastructure that has been planned. We're happy that they're now compliant with these norms and standards. EMS regulations, we came up with regulations for EMS, and it's been a bit of a struggle for provinces to implement and to comply. So we thought perhaps to support them, we had to come up with a compliance checklist and use this to assess the level of implementation, because you'll see that there are always headlines about EMS in this province or the other. So if we have regulations, at least we can monitor whether they are compliant or not. But also the training and education of EMS personnel, we also monitor to check whether they are training EMS personnel, because we have a problem. Most are basic ambulance attendants, not EMS personnel. So we have to ensure that we have appropriately skilled people who provide emergency medical services. So it's a program. We have to come up with policy, regulations, training programs. Now, as part of implementation, there must be a budget. So some provinces are struggling a bit. So we've actually come up with this checklist to check where the barriers are and where the problems are. But we've done the same not just for EMS. We've come up with policy for mass gatherings, you know, so that we don't have incidents when we have big events in South Africa. But we also don't confine this to big events like celebratory kind of events, but also for, you know, these big churches, just to ensure that for mass gatherings they comply, they've got license, they've got ablution facilities, water for people to wash hands and so on. So that kind of mass gathering, a policy framework, is mainly as broad as that. There's also alcohol test. This one, we had set ourselves to have 100%. We reached a target of 78. We set a target of 40% to eliminate toxicology tests. We reached a target of 27.7%. We signed an MOU with Department of Transport, and it's mainly to have breathalyzer testing for roadside testing of alcohol for those who drink and drive, and to ensure that we can address that. For food tests, we have said 100%. Our performance was very poor here, 20.8%. I think those are the highlights, honorable members. I just wanted to say that for certain norms at higher levels of care, we've developed the district, I think we're making progress. We will not be implementing this for regional, tertiary, and central, because it's very complex. We can't use this tool. We will follow a different approach. For, like I say, for forensic chemistry lab, we've not met targets. particularly for toxicology and alcohol. Blood alcohol.
Just interrupt. Within this conference time, we also started late. We are now at 10:30. We go to break at 10 to 11. I don't know. We have two options. One option is to stop the DG presenting, allow members to ask questions with all the issues that we also have from our provinces, and also where we did oversight against what you're presenting. The other option is that we allow the department to finish. I don't know how is your program. We're coming back at 2 to take social development. We can start with you responding to members or members asking questions. Remember, I need your guidance. How do we deal with this? Two options. You allow them to finish a very important presentation. And I don't want to rush members when asking questions. We allow them to finish their presentation. If they're available at 2, we start with them answering questions that would have been, or start with members asking questions and allow them to respond. Then proceed with social development. I need you.
Chairperson, for us, myself and the Deputy Minister, the President will be answering questions in the National Assembly at 2. So we won't be able to attend. Unfortunately, we'll have to be in the National Assembly.
Honourable members, need your guidance.
Chairperson, we are really constrained. Time-wise, my suggestion would be, because the presentation is actually written, we have the copies as members, even though the DG has not yet finished, really, which is now at problem 6, I think. Maybe we could actually continue on our own to read, but afford members the opportunity to ask questions while the minister, the honourable minister and the honourable CM are here to respond to some of the issues that are raised as provinces. It's unfortunate that we want to justice, that is a fact that we can't dispute, but we really do have time constraints. I don't know. That is my suggestion.
Mr. Honourable
We are really between a rock and a hard place, because I don't think we'll even be able to put all the questions before we have to go, let alone their responses. This is so important, I think it actually warrants another session, which I don't know whether we'll get that. We cannot really do justice to what was put on the table here, get interrogated and to get responses in the time that's available. That is unfortunately not the right.
Can you make a suggestion?
I really said it. I think we should go on as far as possible, then stop and have another session with the department. I don't think we need all of the department here. Perhaps a much smaller delegation, looking at expenses, and then interrogate. Otherwise, we will just be forced to go into questions in the House, and we will not even be allowed to put all the questions because of limitations on questions, which is not ideal. So my suggestion is, let's use a time go on instead of start diluting everything.
Next week we are having the full day again, and we are left with the 3 departments. We can either start with them in the morning, depending on the availability, or allow them to come later. I think that's the only day we have left. We have 3 departments, but have a full day. When we decided with this department, the information that we could finish before 11 was not yet there. We could have taken a smaller time. With this one, we can't do with this time that is given. DG, Minister, next week, Tuesday, is it just to come and allow members to ask questions and respond, it might take an hour.
Yeah, we'll have to check our diary.
Yeah, please. That's very important.
Oh, yes. If we don't
have a diary, it's
a compliment. Today it was ideal. Next week we'll try our best, but it might not be ideal. I'm talking in terms of attendance.
Okay, DJ, let's proceed until 10:02.
No.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. No, I just wanted to support the Honorable Minister Motsoaledi. The issue of the diary is very critical. I mean, we cannot take a decision now that they must come back next week. I think it will be very unfair on our part. For me, it sounds like we are putting the cart before the horse. You know, so we need to be very careful. In as much as we agree, the presentation is very important. We all need it. But we also need to acknowledge even the NCOB program committee had to restructure the program. So it's not only us as a committee that we are pressed. Even the program committee of the NCOB is pressurized. I mean, the questions to the deputy president were supposed to have been today. It's deferred until further notice. So many debates, you know, because we need to prioritize legislation and our meetings as committees. So because we are so pressurized, I was going to support the proposal of Mam Zwane that we allow the department to finish their presentation and then probably if there are critical questions and then we pose the questions to the department, they can either return or reply on written questions or something like that to us. If it's not going to be possible that they come back next week, because I'm looking at the possibility if they come back, if they don't come back. So in case they are not going to be able to come back to us, then they can reply to us, in writing, if that's the case. I mean, for me, I look at it like that because it looks like, under difficult circumstances, that might be the only option that we have. So we have to concede as honorable members that no, instead of asking questions now and diluting some of the issues that might have came out of the presentation of the DJ. Let's pack our questions, let's allow the department finish the presentation, and then we put our questions towards the end. Because if you look at it the other way, if we put questions now, we say stop, let's put questions. Those issues might have been covered in the presentation. You know, so for me, it's very difficult. So that's why I'm supporting the proposal of Mam Zwane. Let's allow the DJ. We are left with 20 minutes, 25 minutes. She might be able just to push it and then conclude the presentation. Thanks, Honorable Chair.
Okay, that's the proposal, because Honorable Zwane's proposal was saying let's stop the presentation and ask questions, and also the suggestion that they come next week, it was not final, it was a proposal to them. They were still going to check their diaries. DG?
Honorable members, the minister was saying we could chair. I was just saying on our part as officials will be available on Tuesday. I guess it will be the minister and deputy minister who confirm. So if it's acceptable that we come back to you on that one. But for SAPRA, I don't know whether you've concluded whether they'll do the afternoon session with you at 2 o'clock and that you proceed.
Am I not understanding the members at the end of the table to be saying the issue of time is not only me and the deputy minister, it might also be yourself in terms of programming committees, etc.
Yeah.
I thought you were saying on both sides it might not be possible.
No, we've reworked the program unless something happened today. They've allowed the committees, in fact they've cancelled plenaries today and next week, so that committees will have a full day to deal with issues that are affecting committees. So that is why we are aware that next week we have a full day. We'll meet in the morning and we'll meet in the afternoon. We are aware of that, unless there are other issues.
Mm-hmm.
But plenaries had been cancelled to allow committees to finalize the committee work. In fact, what was new in his proposal is that let's allow you to finish presentations, then questions, members will not have time to question. It could be a question of writing questions, getting responses, but bearing in mind that in terms of the annual report, this is the last time we're meeting with the department to deal with their annual report. Next year we'll not be here as these members. The committee will be here, but maybe as these members today, where the report is being presented to us. So it's an important interaction to deal with it, because like I was saying, we've been to oversight, we are from our provinces, there are issues also that we want to raise with the department, which may not work well when you write to the department and they respond in writing. So I don't know, my suggestion was that let's allow them, in fact we have wasted time now, let's allow them to finish with the SAFSA maybe in the afternoon. I don't know if they're available. We can start with them. It's not long. I don't think their presentation will be long. Can we agree with that? We'll get a confirmation from the minister, but DG is saying they are available as a team. Let's proceed, DG. Sapra, afternoon, are you available?
I think we'll just check up. I think we could make ourselves available. Would you want us to present at 2 o'clock? If possible.
Yeah.
And perhaps you could just let us know how long you'd like us to present, because you know, we can talk, but you might want to say we have half an hour, and so forth, can you present for X amount of time, so we can give...
We come back with the department next week.
Today.
Yeah, because we are having a department already and it's only 2 hours in the afternoon as well. Okay, let me allow you space and allow the DG to proceed with the presentation.
Honourable members, under program 6, I'm starting with SAPRA to say that we signed an MOU with them and we have the two bills, and thanks to the members that the NHLS one has progressed significantly, and now we're busy with NAFISA. The hearings are underway in provinces. So for governance monitoring, we've come up with a governance monitoring framework that we use for oversight, and so far we have reports of 4 health entities and 6 statutory health professional councils. The number of newly appointed boards where there's induction and training, there are 2 new boards where people are appointed, like in SAPRA and Council for Medical School. So we subject them to these tools that we've developed. On HR, this is not the HR for the whole country, it's just at national level. If you see here, we had a total number of approved posts on the establishment as 1,940, and those that are filled are 1,660, so our vacancy rate is 12.5%. Like we said, because of a cap on COE, we very strategic on how we fill posts. We are even abolishing some. On financial management expenditure, so far our budget, the final appropriation was 42,645,557,000. And of these, our actual expenditure is 42,424,691,000 rand. And of all of these, honourable members, remember the significant proportion of our budget is grants, and the grants are largely the National Health Insurance indirect grant, the tertiary services grant, the HIV AIDS grant, the Infrastructure grants. So there are a couple of grants that account for a significant proportion. So the budget that actually resides at national level is a very small proportion of that. So for program one, I'll hand over to the CFO to present and just explain what the material variances are. Regarding the expenditure, even though we spend 99.5, it looks good, but there are obvious specific areas where we will explain our under expenditure or our over expenditure.
Okay, thank you. So just quickly run through it. So on program one, we spent 99.5%. The biggest reason for not spending all of it was that there were some software licenses for forensic laboratories still to be signed, which wasn't done in time. On program two, where we had 91% spent, is mostly to do with the indirect grant and the drug related group project in 2017-18. It was essentially decided that most of it, that there would be an approach to follow the approach the Western Cape has adopted, and that was kind of still a work in progress. On the primary healthcare services, the biggest delay there was the IELTS clinic realization and maintenance invoices. And also the peer review that wasn't conducted, it was conducted, but not all invoices were received on time. Economic classification, you can see that our compensation was at 98% and businesses at 94%. We've transferred close to all of the funds that we have to transfer to NGOs. We have transferred all of that out. On goods and services, as I said, there was a delays in renewing of software licenses. And also in program four, the idle clinic realization maintenance invoice was not received. Transfer subsidies, although we paid close to 100% of the money out to the NGOs, there were still a few that did not comply totally with PFMA or did not apply for funding as expected. And then the capital assets just related back to the DRG project in that financial year. So on conditional grants, we're looking at the conditional grants spent by all provinces. We were at 98.6% spent against an adjusted budget of 37.8 billion, slightly down from last financial year at 99% spent, but we actually spent 4 billion more. The biggest underspend was on the Revive grant, as expected. The other three grants, the training grant, the National Teaching Service grant, HIV grant, were all, you know, in an acceptable norm, if you like, although we still feel that the HPTVG grant should be closer to 99% spent. We have requested rollovers of 353 million, and that's been approved, and also it's linked to committed funds. So I'll show you a slide in a few seconds. So just quickly as an overview, you will see that we've spent, this is just the overview of all the grants spent, confirming that the Revive grant at 94% spent was the lowest spending grant, but the total spent was at 98.6% spent. We also monitor the transfers from provincial treasuries to the provincial departments of health, and you can see that in the case of, for instance, the HIV grant, there was an amount of 140 million not transferred at the time that we did the report. This could probably have changed now with audited numbers, so we just need to include audited numbers, but this was the position as at the end of March. I'm not going to take too much time on the rest of the chair because there's just a breakdown of all the grants. If I can just quickly run through, just to go to page 73 perhaps, this is slide 73. Just to show that from the indirect grant, this is grants that we implement on behalf of provinces. You will see that the NHI component, which has got a number of subcomponents, was sitting at 95% spent. It's actually quite a big improvement from previous financial years where we had a very slow expenditure pattern. Our revised grants sat at 99% spent. Obviously, we had some adjustments during the adjustment stage, but including commitments, we spent most of those funds. Idle clinic was set at 90% spent, but the variance is small in terms of numbers, about 2.8 million. And the HPV component was essentially totally spent. We actually had to have some rollovers in this year for 27 million. So our total grants, our total indirect grants at 97% spent. As I say, it's quite a bigger improvement coming from previous years. Having said that, this 97% includes commitments that we've referred. Then maybe just the last slide I'd like to touch on is on 76. We have applied for all of these rollovers with the provinces to treasuries, and indications are that we've actually received this during the adjustment stage. In the case of Eastern Cape, there was some money spent on a training grant for Malanga and Northern Cape. That has been rolled over through the provincial processes. But significantly, you'll see that in the revived grant, most provinces have asked for rollovers because of their low spending. And for the most part, this has been approved. And I can just add that in the case of Northern Cape, they had no rollover request because they spent all their money. But we've made some provision for them in this adjustment stage in this financial year. So, Chair, I will leave it there. Thanks.
Under normal circumstances, I would ask the Minister to close the presentation, but time does not allow. No, thank you very much, Minister, Deputy Minister, DG, and the team. If there are changes, we'll meet next week. I don't think it will be, we would have liked the Minister and the Deputy to be there, but it will depend on your program. Thank you very much. All members will meet at 2. Thank you for your time.